One of Detroit's consistent stories has been that of speculators. Exactly how do we determine who is a speculator, and is land speculation helping or hurting Detroit? This is an important question. My next guest has figured out speculators own nearly 20% of all land parcels in Detroit. Joshua Akers is an assistant professor of social sciences at the University of Dearborn and University of Michigan Dearborn, and he's one of the creators of an interactive website. It's called propertypraxis.org. Joshua Akers, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you define speculator for purposes of this interactive website you've developed?
One is if you're an individual that owns three or more properties but don't have a taxable address in the neighborhood, so you're not there. The second is if you hold a large number of properties, but they're in various conditions. You may have some that are active businesses. You may have some that are vacant lots. You have vacant and abandoned houses. But there's some differences there. And then the third category, in which you'll find some single owners in our list, if you're out of state or out of country and you have a property that's vacant and abandoned, you're on the list.
Vacant and abandoned versus family, say, living in a house?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So now we got a kind of a sense of what we talk about with a speculator. Is land speculation in and of itself a bad thing, something destructive to a struggling city?
In a functioning market, land speculation may not be a bad thing. Economists would argue that speculation determines price. You have people willing to go out and take a risk and set a price, and then you begin to set a market where people will exchange. And that may hold if we just took property as a financial instrument.
Because you started with that clause, in a functioning market.
Right.
So when we look at Detroit,
there's one, it's not a functioning property market. But two, property itself isn't just a financial instrument. So you think about the home that you or I live in. It's about how we use it. And oftentimes it's chosen by the neighborhood that we can live in or the community that it's engaged in. When you're just purely speculating on the finances of it, it actually removes that property from the neighborhood itself.
How so? Because when you think that maybe a house has just been sitting there with no one taking any action or any responsibility, so it would just be deteriorating anyway. So let's say if somebody comes in and buys it for speculative purposes, at least something's being done with it.
Not necessarily, right?
Okay.
It may be held in the same state that it was in and allowed to deteriorate. There's all kinds of varieties of speculation. But if we just take a residential property and you think about somebody buying it in the case that you've given to me here, they're usually just making a bet that someone else is going to do something around them that increases the value. They're not investing in the property. They're not engaged in keeping it up. And it's not actively circulated for another family to take up as a residence.
So it's basically taking it and putting it up on the shelf.
Right. You could think about it as circulating in a financial realm as opposed to in the neighborhood.
So in Detroit, what effects have we seen from property speculation?
Part of where this project came from is work with community groups and activists in the neighborhood. So I've been working in Detroit for about 6 years. And one of the things that's come up really in the last 3 years is a lot of properties in our neighborhoods are being bought up and we don't know who's doing it. Or when we look at the records, we can't figure out who it is. Right? So you have a number of limited liability companies operating, which are, it's a shell company. If you're a business owner, it protects your assets. So if you were to get sued, it's only the things inside the business. But one of the other things it can do, if you're a property speculator and you don't want people to know who you are, is it hides who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a community group or an activist and you're concerned about your neighborhood, or you're just a neighbor that wants to buy a home for, you know, perhaps your sister or someone else, finding out who to contact and do something about it is nearly impossible.
Okay, like peeling away the layers of an onion.
Right. So what we tried to do is both reveal who those owners and members of the LLCs are, to give community groups and activists a new way to think about and frame their neighborhood. These are the people that live in your neighborhood as well. They may not actually physically live there, but they own a piece of it, and their actions are affecting.
So when you go, like I've got my laptop up now, so propertypraxis.org, and without even having to think, the most well-known name when you talk about Detroit property speculators has to be Maddie Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge. So you type M-O-R-O-U-N, and oh my goodness, there are
599.
Oh, my word. So I click on that, and all of those things that have lit up, I see a map of the city. I see purple. I see red. I see blue. I see little lots. I see great big things. They're all his in one way or shape or form.
In his case, when you click on his name, you'll see red. So we have a category of speculators with over 500 properties. There's only four people in that category. They show as red. Maroon is one of those.
Okay.
Once you click on his name, Those that are just lit up in red, if you scroll out in the map, are his properties.
Okay. Who are some of the other big names?
Melvin Washington. He's a developer in the city of Detroit. He's done a number of for-profit, low-income developments. But he also holds 799 properties in various conditions. And that's why he's there. And the activities of these two individuals are quite different. Like I was saying, there's a variety of speculation. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Melvin Washington, it seems to be that he's acquiring larger plots close together to eventually do a development that has not come to fruition yet or he doesn't have the financing for. In the case of Maroon, it's more about strategy and protecting his businesses. So you see a lot of properties around the Ambassador Bridge. He owns the bridge, but he also owns a number of trucking companies and logistics companies. You know, if you look near the bridge, there's the Detroit-Renzer rail tunnel. He owns a number of properties around there. There have been numerous proposals by the owners of that tunnel to put in a new tunnel, which takes double-stack rail cars, and to turn those old tunnels into trucking tunnels. If you add double-stack rail and add those trucking tunnels, you've affected that bridge business quite dramatically.
So he is not going to say yes to that.
Right. Or he puts himself in a position that
he's doing it.
He can coordinate how that might happen. You see a number of purchases around the site of the new bridge that's supposed to go in there. You see a number of purchases out by City Airport, which has been proposed as a larger logistics hub, kind of betting on possible future expansion of that airport.
I'm interested in if we have any sense of how many of these speculators are outside of Michigan, even outside of the United States. Are we seeing a lot of that type of speculation?
You see some. One of the more interesting findings in this research is there's a lot of work out there right now about foreign direct investment, which is overseas speculators buying condominiums, buying properties, driving markets up. You see a lot of that here in Ann Arbor currently going on. In the case of Detroit, about 7% of those properties identified as speculation track back to addresses out of state or out of country. It's a relatively small number.
There is a Irish consumer advocate. He's kind of a celebrity consumer advocate named Eddie Hobbs. And his firm, Brendan Investment Pan-European Property, bought up a number of properties in Detroit. And I dug up an editorial from the Irish Independent from 2014. It's from the 11th of March. Headline, Detroit's loss is Hobbs's gain. His name is Eddie Hobbs. And as it says, Eddie Hobbs seems to be doing okay from the decline of Detroit. And it talks about property that he invested in empty houses in Detroit. And the final line just kind of jumped out at me here. I'm quoting the Irish Independent. Nice to see that there are one or two Irish vulture funds engaged in a bit of bottom feeding as well as the U.S. variety. Is bottom feeding equal to speculators? Is it an equation? Does speculation have to, you know, equate to bottom feeding?
No, but it becomes more profitable when it is. Not all speculation is necessarily bottom feeding, like we were talking about in the case of Maroon. It's very strategic in that case. Or in Melvin Washington, he's looking to do development. But in the kind of categories that we've built out, are those people that are sitting between 100 and 500 properties, you see a lot more of that. People looking for cheap properties using the Wayne County tax foreclosure auction, using mortgage foreclosure sell-offs by HUD and other people to buy large quantities of property. And these are often being remarketed, in some cases as wholesale, right? So you have some, Ed Azar is a great example. Edward Azar grew up in Southeast Michigan. He's in Palm Beach, Florida. His entire business model, he'll sell individual homes, but he buys a large number of homes and then tries to sell them wholesale to other people that want to be property speculators. You see UK and Irish investment funds buying properties in Detroit that go into an investment portfolio, like a real estate investment portfolio, then selling shares on a larger portfolio that may include houses from Detroit that are completely uninhabitable and may include some in Orlando that actually have rentals in them.
So while all of that shuffling is going on, and I'm living on a street with houses that are owned by these speculators that are just sitting and decaying, and I can't buy it if I want to, as you say, to move my sister in there. The deepest impact on Detroit neighborhoods is that it can suck the life out of the neighborhoods.
Absolutely. What it looks to us like a slow decay of vacant and abandoned property or something that's static, these properties are actually moving quite quickly in financial markets around the world. Capital is changing hands all the time. Titles are changing hands all the time. And the friction from that, the outcome of that, are the conditions that we see in the city.
So when we say Detroit's decline, there's been so much focus on, well, the deindustrialization or people leaving, packing up and heading north of 8 Mile and moving out to the suburbs. True that those certainly are part of it, but we have to consider what's happening here.
Deindustrialization, globalization, huge processes that have great effects on Detroit. But if we look at Detroit in the last 20 or 30 years, it begs the question, what's happening? What is still going on? And part of the site and most of my research has been about making the argument that we need to focus on the production of decline. What are the activities that continue to produce the conditions that we see today? And speculation is one of those things.
So what do you hope people can take away from going to propertypraxis.org?
We could think of it in a number of different ways. For those community groups and activists that I've worked with, I hope that they can see new pathways for action, ways to confront these conditions in their neighborhoods. From a policy perspective at the city level, hopefully they can see the scale. When we talk about ownership in the city, 20% is speculator. The city owns a massive amount of property, nearly 100,000 parcels now. That's 30%. The next largest category is basically 50% of individual owners. So we're talking about a huge category that needs some kind of action. And as we're spending tens of millions, if not over hundreds of millions of dollars on this idea of eliminating blight now, I think the fundamental argument that we're trying to get across is that we need to focus upstream. This is an incredible cost that's borne by the public, and yet it's actively produced. We can see who is producing it. So that opens the possibility for taking action before it becomes a public responsibility.
Joshua Akers is an assistant professor of social sciences at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, one of the creators of this interactive website. You can go to propertypraxis.org. Again, that's propertypraxis.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Joshua.
Thank you very much.